As a pet owner, you probably keep track of the regular preventative steps that will keep your pet happy and healthy, like shots and heartworm, flea and tick treatments, that sort of thing. But if another dog attacks yours, you need to know in the moment what to do to assess the injuries, to hold the other owner responsible. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine takes time every month to spend with us, with you and me, to give us advice on keeping our pets happy and healthy. And Dr. Sandy, great to have you back.
It's nice to be here.
You are obviously a pet health professional, but you're also a pet owner, and you had a serious situation occur with your own bulldog, Pete.
I did. Pete, my one-year-old bulldog. He's one of the few bulldogs that is able to exercise, and we go on approximately, even a little bit more, 2-mile run walk every night. And I'm just in my neighborhood out for a walk, and a fellow came by with two dogs on retractable leashes. He was on rollerblades, and one of the dogs just ran over and nailed Pete and bit him, went for the neck, got some good puncture wounds in. And me, being a typical upset owner, okay, was so worried about my dog, I didn't get any information from the guy, and he took off. But I had witnesses, so everything's going to be working out all right. But here's the mistakes that I made. Number one, I looked at Pete's wounds and I said, okay, I see like one tooth mark and things didn't look that bad. And so when I took him home, he was still happy and playful and it wasn't bleeding. It just looked like a little small puncture hole. And so I didn't do anything about it. I just kind of cleaned up the wound and we went to bed. He woke up later in the middle of the night with 104.5 fever. Panting like crazy, and it was obvious that we had a nice infected wound. And so one thing that you always remember is if your dog is injured, have those injuries looked at, especially if it looks minor, it can still be pretty major. That dog was able to pull all the skin away from his neck, and so he's had a lot of skin, but was able to, you know, cause a lot of tissue damage underneath what we could see. So unfortunately, Pete ended up going into the emergency room. I don't do surgery, and I don't like to do work on my own pets. And he ended up having drains put in. He was on antibiotics, pain medication, and I'm happy to say that he's all healed up and doing fine. So, you know, my mistake was I didn't get him looked at right away, and I should have. I know better. So that's one thing for people to be aware of, is that injuries can be much more serious. The other thing that I wanted to bring up is, you know, we talk about these retractable leashes, and they are just the most unsafe thing that you could use with your dog. You really don't have control over your dog. I've actually had a couple of patients get one severely injured and one actually killed. They were out for a walk and something spooked the dog and they took off into the middle of the street and got hit. One of the owners actually was yanked into the street and broke her hip. And the dog was injured as well. And so, you know, if you're using those, you know, you can't trust the brakes on it. There's a little brake mechanism on it. They tend to be rather clumsy and hard to hold on to. Go to a regular leash rather than using the retractable leads. And that was probably one of the reasons why we had issues with this dog, is that the person who was on the other end didn't have control over the dog. Take your phone with you when you're out for a walk. I didn't do that. I could have taken pictures. I could have, written down information. But of course, I was just, you know, in my running shoes with my dog and didn't have anything with me. So now I'm being a little more cautious, which kind of irks me that I have to be that way. You know, realize that dogs are, in our state, considered property. They are not considered family members. And so in the eyes of the law, they are just strictly property, and you cannot, you know, get any financial compensation for pain and suffering or anything. It's just the value of the dog. And so, you know, it's kind of a bummer that way. It is changing around the country. I think California is now looking at renaming dogs and cats and not looking at them as property, but more personal companions. Make sure your dogs are licensed. Make sure that they're up to date on all their vaccines, because that is one of those things that's going to come up, especially if it does become a legal battle, is your dog current on vaccines? And a big thing is do not try to separate the dogs with your hands, because if I had, I probably would have been bit. Maybe would have changed the outcome a little bit, because now when a human gets bit, then things really, the law really gets into play. But, you know, separating them can be a real trick. And I ended up, just grabbing Pete's back legs and pulling him away, using my foot to kind of push on the other dog while the other guy just stood by and watched. So anyways, that is just a few little words of wisdom. You know, you've got to have your dog socialized. And if they aren't socialized and you know that there's a risk for attack, there is absolutely nothing wrong with using a basket muzzle, one of those like police muzzles that they can drink water through them, they can take treats through them, and yet you don't have to worry about injury to other dogs. So I'm hoping that, you know, this will give people that idea that, you know, I actually compliment people for recognizing my dog has an issue and I want to give him exercise, but I can't be out there safely because he's afraid of kids or he's afraid of other dogs or whatever. You know, go ahead and cover yourself by making sure the dog has a muzzle on.
Now, legally, does the owner of a dog, say I own a dog and the dog bites the neighbor dog?
Well, the neighbor dog, that's a huge problem. I am actually having to go to small claims court to cover this. It's a civil matter, and so I am doing this. I'm actually going to go after them for the medical costs for my dog. But it's a really tricky place. I would expect someone that has a pet to be responsible and say I will pay for whatever has to be done. But even if you go to dog parks and so on, it's all, you know, user beware that there is no law that says you will have to cover them. And even property insurance would potentially do that. But again, good luck.
It didn't. Yeah, good luck. Wow. So lots of things to consider there. And if you own a dog and you're taking your dog out and your dog is one who might attack another dog or another person, obviously you need to have that dog muzzled and you need to have that dog on some sort of leader.
Right. That is, you've got control over it. And, next week, actually starting on the 17th, is National Dog Bite Prevention Week. And although that is primarily directed towards dog bites to people, I think there's a lot of great information on the American Veterinary Medical Association's avma.org/dog bite prevention. And one of the things that I always point to people is learn dog body language, because you can really, prevent a lot of problems if you can recognize where we're going to start running into troubles. And there's a very nice poster that you can get for free if you're in a situation where you need to be talking about this, like maybe in schools or something like that. A veterinarian who has passed away, but her name is Dr. Sophia Yin, and her website is just drsophiayin.com, okay? Mm-hmm. And she has one that's on body language of fear in dogs, and it's excellent. Wonderful for kids to look at, and there's even apps that you can have on your phone for how to read dogs' body language.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along today. If you'd like to join in, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Certainly love to hear from you. Before we talk to others, I know last month you gave us a lot of great information about canine influenza, that outbreak. Is there, do you have a recap for listeners who aren't familiar with it and maybe also give us an update?
Yeah, well, that was a month ago today. Everything kind of just hit the fan at that point. I can remember coming back from the show and having all kinds of people on, the press wanting information, and it's kind of died down now. Does it mean that this particular influenza virus is gone? Not at all. It's here, and it's probably going to continue to spread, but I think awareness has made people a lot more cautious about it. This is, we have two types of influenza in the United States right now. One that we've recognized for about the last 10, 11 years. It's called H3N8. It causes a runny nose, coughing, fever, sometimes progressing to pneumonia. The dogs are very lethargic. For the most part, most dogs are going to get over it, but some, especially if they are elderly or very young, may succumb to secondary things like pneumonia unless they get good supportive care. And we started to see last month a outbreak of similar type symptoms, but much worse, in the Chicago area. And it was not just Chicago, but all of kind of northern Illinois. And we had one case here in Madison that was diagnosed at the UW Veterinary School. And through looking into this, it just wasn't behaving like the normal influenza that we see. It was found at our Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab in conjunction with Cornell University to be a Asian Korean type virus that has been endemic over there called H3N2. And here's the dilemma. We've got a vaccine for H3N8, but we don't have one for H3N2. And we don't know if it's going to provide any protection or not. Some kennels are recommending that you have your pet vaccinated for it. If you are planning on boarding your dog this summer, check ahead of time. It takes a good month from the beginning, getting that first inoculation, 2 weeks later, a second one, and then 2 weeks after that, your dog may have some protection for the H3N8. We don't know about the H3N2. So
well, that's 6 weeks.
Or yeah, well, it's a couple. Yeah, a good month or so. Yeah, but it's better. Just catch up on checking with your kennel what they require. And if your dog is elderly, maybe consider leaving them at home or having a pet sitter just so they're not put through that stress.
Yeah. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today. Again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheryl Gasser, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. And again, you can join us, 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And we would certainly love to hear from you. So give us a call or shoot us a note. And let's see, we can take some calls. Let's go to Joe in Wausau. Joe, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a dog bite story. I was walking my little poodle on the sidewalk in Wausau, and I looked down, and there was this large black dog that had my little poodle in its jaws. And the woman who owned the dog was watering the garden in the backyard, and the dog had run out to the sidewalk and grabbed my little poodle. So to make a long story short, I went to the vet. And, actually, I called the police, and they went over to the owner's house and took the dog information and the owner's name, and I went to the vet. It cost me $250 for x-rays and antibiotics, and I was lucky that the city attorney pursued that, and I wound up getting reimbursed for the veterinary bill of $250.
Well, you're very lucky. The community that I'm in is much less helpful, let's just say, that I heard numerous times through the police that Pete was just a dog, and why am I making such a big deal about this? So it's I think it really is kind of community based, and I'm glad that you're in an area that helps support you and your dog, because that's happened with me as well. Walking, I used to have basset hounds, and I can remember moving to a new community, and we were looking at where we wanted to eventually buy a house, and we would just jump in the car and go to different neighborhoods and go for a walk to get a feel, and all of a sudden, this little dog came running out and just started nailing my old basset hound. And the owner came out, "Well, why didn't you? You should know that she's got puppies in the house." And I'm like, "No, I don't even live here." So, you do need to have your dog under control. And that's one of the issues that we have too with these, and like the electronic fences that we have for dogs. There's no way of you know, keeping dogs from roaming in that are not wearing the collar. And, you know, and so dogs that are in behind those fences, they better be well socialized, because you never know who's going to cross over, whether it be a child, another dog, another species like a cat, could potentially, you know, wander in. So, you know, you've got to know what your dog is like and contain them appropriately.
Yeah.
I think in this community, we have classifications. A vicious dog bites a person. A dangerous dog maybe bites another dog or threatens someone. So under those categories, they are able to pursue the owner of
Well, that's
very good. So I wish I lived where you do.
Joe in Wausau, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Jeanette in La Crosse has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi. I was wondering, is it possible that dogs have ADHD? I got a new puppy, rescue puppy. We figure he's part Corgi, part Chihuahua, and he is wild. I mean, he is just, we have a 6-year-old Chihuahua Terrier mix, and he just torments that poor dog. He wants to play 24/7, and then he's piddling different places around the house, and you try to put his nose in it and tell him no, you know, and he just thinks that's another game. Bouncing
well,
off the walls.
Well, I'm hearing a few things. One, you've got a relatively sedate middle-aged dog that is, you know, you're used to, and now you've got a puppy. And puppies, unless they know exactly what you want them to do, are going to get in trouble. And so lots of training classes, looking into doggy daycare so they can play all day with other dogs that may want to interact with them. Lots and lots of exercise, you know, walking, playing with the dog outside, with toys and so on. Housebreaking, rubbing their nose in it. Remember, dogs love to put their nose up to urine. I mean, when was the last time you walked your dog past a fire hydrant where they didn't take in the aroma of other dogs' urine? And so you putting their nose in it is not teaching them to eliminate outdoors. What it's teaching them is to avoid going, eliminating in front of the owner, because bad things may happen, or it may train your dog to not like hands coming to them. So I always use the example of if your husband left the toilet seat up and you got mad and you just grabbed him by the scruff and took him over and gave him a swirly, would he remember that that's because he left the toilet seat up, or just think you're a crazy person? I think it's the latter. Okay, so you know, so don't do that for training, and that may be adding to it, that the dog is just anxious living in your house if you just keep saying no, 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 and they don't know what yes is, they don't know what they can do, that can add to a dog being, you know, as you say, wild, because they just don't know how to behave in that situation. We do, but back to your question, do we see hyperactivity in dogs? It is a rarely diagnosed condition in dogs. The way we diagnose it is we usually videotape the dog while it's in a situation like a kennel and see how many times it paces, runs, circles, barks, does some repetitive behavior, and then we treat them with the appropriate drugs we would use, like Ritalin or something, and then we watch to see, did the behavior change? Did we decrease that level of activity that the dog was having? The majority of these dogs are just behavioral, and it just, you need to do those things that I talked about at the beginning.
So give him a lot of exercise, get him socialized, some additional training.
You got it. You got it. So the dog knows what is the right thing to do.
There we go. Thank you very much, Jeanette, for calling. I appreciate your call. I want to give Edie and Baraboo a chance to join us. Edie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Boy, I love the thing about the husband in the toilet seat. That is great. That's the funniest thing I've ever heard. I have a little puppy. I got him. He's about 10 months old. He's a Shih Tzu. No. He's Maltese and Blue Heeler Cross. So he's pretty smart. Mm-hmm. But he is afraid of everything.
Yeah.
And I got him as a puppy, and he hasn't been mistreated, and he hasn't been,
How old was he when you got him?
He was about 3 months.
3 months old. Okay. And where did he come from at that point?
Well, my sister raised him.
Okay. All right.
In the house with two other puppies.
Okay.
And, but he's had no trauma in his life.
Yeah, yeah.
But when we walked down the road, I got a three-year-old Chihuahua mix that is his friend. When we walk down the road, if there's a pop can that got thrown out, he's afraid of it. He'll go way away from it.
Yeah. I mean, and so much of this behavior, there's kind of two thoughts, and they probably interact together quite a lot. One is it's genetic. And so we do know that the extremes of behavior, that really controlling, assertive dog versus the really super fearful dog, there may be a strong genetic component to this. So that may be part of it. The other is that you got him when he was 3 months old. And that the real critical socialization period for the dog starts well before that point. So I would have hoped that your sister had taken this dog out and taken them to places where there's going to be loud noises and kids playing and, you know, oddball things on the street and garbage cans. And if he was just raised in the house, unfortunately, he missed some of that critical socialization time. And it's not saying that if a dog is in kind of a sterile environment and doesn't get exposed to a lot of things, you can't turn them around. It just makes it a whole lot more difficult. Because, I mean, we'll see some dogs that are, you know, shelter-raised, kennel-raised dogs that just turn into model citizens and are happy-go-lucky about everything. But I think a combination of probably genetics and the way the dog was raised early on has really had a setback. Now, what I'd be recommending is working with a behaviorist, okay? I would look with either an applied animal behaviorist or a veterinary behaviorist, because your dog may need to be on some type of psychoactive drug just to be able to feel more comfortable. An anti-anxiety medication, sometimes we'll use things like fluoxetine, Prozac-type drugs, which are now labeled for dog use. Very few side effects and can be quite effective at helping you go through some of the training to get him comfortable with things. And so right now, taking him for a walk where he's going to have a fearful experience, maybe pushing it too far. You may have to have a more controlled environment where you can make very gradual changes to the things that he's exposed to so he can start to develop that confidence. Is it going to take a lot of work? You got it. Is he going to be a normal dog? Probably not. But I think, you know, just give him time and understanding and make sure that, you know, everything you're doing is positive with lots of food rewards and, you know, just very gentle handling. And hopefully you'll have a dog that enjoys life a little bit more.
Yeah.
Well, I do take him with me most of the time. And I go to the nursing home and visit people, and I take him along there, take treats along, and the little ladies feed him. And eventually he will come up to him.
Yeah, if you can't control the dog and or, you know, the dog's state of mind, you really need to control the environment that they're in. And maybe even the nursing home, if he's that scared going in there, may be too much. It may mean that you just have to go into the front door of the nursing home and have somebody that is already trained ahead of time to not look at him, not lean over him, not reach for him, make no loud noises, squat down at a distance, maybe toss some treats to him, and then he leaves. And he starts learning, oh, this isn't so bad. No one's going to threaten me. So it's very, very slow process, but it can be done.
Thanks, Edie, and good luck. Appreciate your call very much. I want to give Beverly in Rushford a chance to join us. Bev, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a whole array of veterinarian clinics in my area, and this time I took my beautiful rescue shepherd with me to have her update on her. I wanted to get a blood draw for the heartworm for the year, and I called. I made the appointment. I went over. I walked in, and I was taken with my dog to an examination room, which followed up with about four young women who came marching into the room and told me that they were going to take my beauty to another area in the clinic, which is a very posh clinic.
Mm-hmm.
And I just looked at him and I said, "Oh, really?" And they said yes, and I said, "Well, why would you do that?" And they said, "Well, because you would get excited, and it would excite her."
Mm-hmm. That's one good reason. Uh huh.
And so I looked up and I said, "Well, I would have to be with her."
Mm-hmm.
And I rose up, and without another word from anybody, I walked out with my dog.
Uh-huh.
Now, I feel that I am, to some extent, disabled, and she and I sleep together. We do everything. We ride together. We do everything together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I had no reason to not wonder what they were going to do to my dog to make them feel that she might not be dependable.
Yeah. You know, that's a really good question, because it actually just came up this morning. We had an owner call that wanted to know if they could be in the room while the dog was having an abdominal ultrasound done. And at the veterinary school, we do not allow owners. And that would even include me, because my older bulldog had an ultrasound done last fall, and I was told I could not be in the room while they were doing it. And part of the problem, part of the concern is, you know, if they find something, they want to be able to discuss it without getting me upset or me questioning what they're doing. I can tell you that I would not question how they're being restrained or held or anything, that they would be not doing anything that I would be against with my dog. But it was more for just, you know, being able to get a quick diagnosis without having somebody there. So this is a little different, though, with drawing blood. And it really is kind of the culture of the clinic at the veterinary school, because we're working with senior veterinary students that sometimes can be a little nervous having an audience. We will often have the pet taken from the room with the owner, where we have trained veterinary technicians and all of our equipment and so on for getting the samples that we need in another room to be able to get that blood sample drawn. And it's primarily to take the stress off of the student. But that's not your case. When I was in private practice, and even now when I have some patients, we, you know, if the patient is behaving well and it's obvious that we can get the sample in the room very easily without having to add, you know, extra people in to help hold, we will often do things like that in front of the owner. Some owners do get upset. They don't want to see blood. They don't want to see needles. And it can be, you know, quite scary for them to be able to see their dog being held. And, you know, sometimes it also depends on the temperament of the dog. Too, if we've got a dog that we're not trusting, maybe they're wonderful with the owner, but as soon as we start to hold them in a certain position to be able to get a blood sample or a urine sample, they get reactive. They can sometimes be worse in the presence of the owner, and so having them away from the owner can sometimes make them feel, you know, like, okay, I'll just, you know, go with you and get this done. And so we don't have that added problem of the owner being there and, you know, complicating things by saying, "What are you doing to my dog? You know, why are they, you know, why are you putting a muzzle on them?" Because sometimes we have to do that to be able to get procedures done. So I'm kind of beating around the bush here, but it's very kind of a clinic culture, as well as the temperament of the pet, as well as the feelings of the owner. And so we really take all those things into consideration. And one of the things that you could have done is just say, would you mind just trying to draw the blood in the room with me being present? And if they did and they were unable to be successful because the dog kept trying to escape to get back to you, then they may have, sometimes what we'll do is even ask the owner to leave the room so the dog can still stay in the room and the owner can be just on the other side of the door, even looking through the glass so they can see what's going on. So we'd really try to accommodate owners as much as we can. And I'm sorry that you had a bad experience, but, you know, maybe give them another try and just talk ahead of time and say, is it possible for me to be there?
Mm-hmm. Lots of things to consider there, Beverly. And you know what? If you're not happy with that, you did say that there were several vet clinics in mm-hmm. your area. Yeah. You know, you might just
it's
ahead of time ask.
Ask ahead of time. And I know at the veterinary school we will often accommodate owners to the best of our ability. The one thing I do not accommodate, though, because we are a teaching hospital, is owners saying they don't want a student touching the pet. If an owner asks me that, I just say, where do you want your record sent? Because, that is our whole mission, is to not only provide excellent medical care, but also to provide the students with
training,
the experience that they need.
Yeah, absolutely. Beverly, thank you again for calling. I appreciate it. That was a good question.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all good questions. We have great listeners. Lee and Cudahy, what's on your mind? Hi.
Hi. I called a couple months ago about getting a dog.
Yeah.
And we got a dog from the Humane Society.
Good.
And she's 5 years old. But I have two questions. One is, they gave her a vaccine. She's 5 years old. It's called a puppy vaccine of DHPP.
Okay.
It doesn't have the L in it.
Okay.
And do I have to go through a series of puppy things because she's 5 years old still? If she only weighs 8 pounds.
Oh, that is a really good question. The distemper parvo combination vaccine that your dog was given, really, it's going to depend if they've been vaccinated before. And typically, a five-year-old dog probably has had some vaccines before. So we would most likely, if felt that it was time to re-inoculate the dog, do it now, and then probably 3 years down the road, we would repeat it again. The single dose, because it's a modified live vaccine, a single dose in an adult animal is usually adequate. Where we run into troubles is puppies, because the reason why we give a series of vaccinations to puppies, usually they're getting 2, 3, 4 distemper parvo vaccinations, depending on when you start administering them, is because they get some passive immunity from their mother through the milk. And there's no way of knowing when that individual is going to respond to those ingredients in the vaccine. For some dogs, they may respond at that very first vaccine. For others, it may not be until they're 16 weeks of age or older until you get a good response to it. So probably you just need to be using that one vaccine. And if she had never been vaccinated in the past, I would probably booster it in a year and then go every 3 years. But if she has been vaccinated in the past, I would just do the single one and then probably do it 3 years down the road.
Okay. Well, the Humane Society did that one.
Okay.
They did the one without the L in it.
Yeah. One of the things that's kind of my pet peeve is the L stands for leptospirosis, and leptospirosis is a bacteria, and the other parts of the vaccine are all viral. And so you're mixing viral components and bacterial components in the same syringe. And that has been actually found to be one of the causes of causing allergic reactions, vaccine reactions. And there's a strong push to get these combination vaccines that include leptospirosis off of the market. They're very convenient in that you only have to give the dog one inoculation. But your best way of being able to vaccinate your dog for lepto is to, even if you give it at the same time as the distemper parvo vaccination, give it in a separate location on the body, in a separate syringe, and that will help cut down on some of the allergic reactions. So okay. I applaud your veterinarian for not using the combination vaccine or the shelter.
That was the Humane Society.
Yeah, okay, that's perfect. Lepto vaccine is considered a lifestyle vaccine. The shelter is going to vaccinate for the core vaccines, things like rabies, distemper, and parvo, that are life-threatening diseases that every dog needs to be vaccinated for. For the other things like Lyme disease and leptospirosis and canine influenza and all these other vaccines that are out there, it all really depends on what the dog's lifestyle is and where they live. And so that's something that after they're adopted, that is something that you and your veterinarian can work out an appropriate vaccination schedule for your dog. The shelter is not in a position to know what the lifestyle of the dog's going to be.
Yeah, there we go. Good points there. Lee, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to mention Sherry in Madison, who had a question. She has a 1-year-old rescue dog with heartworm disease. He's starting treatment now. She's wondering if you can tell her what you think about prognosis.
Well, it really depends. I mean, prognosis is usually good, but the treatment is so prolonged. Typically, what we do for treatment, remember, heartworm is a parasite that is spread by mosquitoes. So my guess is that this time of the year, this dog was probably from down south and got imported up here. That's where we're seeing a lot of our heartworm-positive dogs, are dogs that have been imported to our area from high heartworm areas. But within the dog's body, you may have the adult heartworms that are showing up on the heartworm test. You may have the circulating baby form that is called microfilaria, and you may have some of the early stages, the immature stages,
boy,
that are haven't reached the cardiovascular system yet and are still circulating through the tissues, and those are the very early larval stages. So typically what we do to heartworm, treat a heartworm-positive dog, is we get them on a heartworm preventative. We want to just get them on that to get some of those tissue stages that may still be in the early form for at least a couple of months. We get them also going on an antibiotic called doxycycline, because the big reaction that we see when we're treating and killing heartworms is there's another parasite that actually lives in the heartworm called Wolbachia.
Oh.
So we kill the adults and this Wolbachia gets released, and that's what causes most of the lung changes. So we usually put them on a month of doxycycline to kill this parasite that is living in the adult heartworm. Then we give it a single injection of a drug that kills the adult worms. Your dog goes home for a 1 month of complete strict rest in a kennel, out to go to the bathroom on a leash, and back in. Often they have to be sedated during this time. After a month, they come back in and they get another dose. 24 hours later, another dose of this injectable drug that can be painful, and they often have to be on pain medication because it burns and it's irritating, and then another month of complete rest. So you've got, for the next 3-4 months,
wow,
a lot of fun to go through.
Wow.
That's why it's so much better to prevent heartworm disease than treat it after the fact. So get your dogs tested and get them on heartworm preventative.
Oh, and here's Sherry with a rescue. There yeah. we go. Well, lots of great information coming out, going in and going out today here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, Cheryl Gasser, our on-air producer, and our guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Now we're continuing our conversation with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk about keeping your pets happy and healthy. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Myra in Green Bay up next with a question. Hi, Myra.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have an English setter. It's the field grade, and he was a hunting dog for most of his life. He is now 16 years old. He is blind and he is deaf. And when I was hunting one time, he was hit by a car, and he has bad hips. So when he goes up the steps, he bunny hops. He
yeah.
seems to be a happy, happy dog. But, you know, he is on Ramadil for his hips.
Mm-hmm.
Am I putting him through too much? You know, is he uncomfortable?
Yeah, those.
Am I keeping him alive for me?
That's a question that really only you can answer. But I'm going to just give you a few things what I tell people that are in this situation. First of all, amazing. A 16-year-old dog that is a you know, working dog. Oh, my goodness. Talk about good genes to make it to be that, you know, that age. That's a really
amazing.
When you're looking at life expectancy is usually closer to about 12 years in that type of breed.
Right.
So phenomenal. So you've done something right for sure, or with just been luck of the draw with good genes. So things that I look at is, yes, is, you know, is there anything else that we can do for pain control? You know, obviously you've got him on an anti-inflammatory. Sometimes we can add in other drugs that would complement that. There's a drug called tramadol that we use frequently. Sometimes we'll put them on gabapentin, and that helps some of these dogs. Sometimes there's other things that you can do, such as physical therapy or acupuncture, that may help alleviate some of the pain. But, you know, so it sounds like you're dealing with that. And if you can even, like, change, make sure his bedding is padded enough and that you can be there to maybe help him up and down the stairs because it's painful for him. If he is able to still make it outside and eliminate on his own without soiling himself, because that can be really degrading for a dog, I think that is one of those things that we need to be looking at as well, not only for your dog's happiness, but your happiness too. If his appetite's still good, I mean, a lot of dogs will eat right up to the very end, so we don't put a lot of emphasis on that. But if all of a sudden, you know, he's just not eating as well and you have to use things to tempt him, then he may not be very happy. Remember, dogs and cats are animals, and when they are uncomfortable, they know that because they're living in a predator prey world, that if they show weakness, then they may become someone's lunch. And so often pets will hide pain up until the very end, and if they really are showing signs of pain, then it is something to sit up and take notice about. Is he happy? Happiness things. You've had him for a long time, and you kind of know what are the things that make him just the happiest dog in the world. And I can tell you that when my own dog got to the point where it was like, okay, it's time, I always said that when Vanna doesn't want to go for a car ride anymore, that's the time when she's not happy, because that was the biggest joy in her life. She didn't ever want to get out of the car. She hated the destination, but she loved the trip there. And so every dog is different as to things that make them happy. And so you know best, you know, if that favorite toy he's not interested in, or, you know, he's, you know, maybe he just likes to sit next to you while you're watching TV and now he's socially isolating himself. You know, you've got to, you know, all these things kind of interplay. And there's a scale that's used, and it's called the HHHMM scale, and it stands for, like, happiness, hydration, hygiene, and it's based on the something from hospice for people. And many veterinarians have taken that and actually turned it around, and they call it the journeys scale. And each letter of the word journey stands for the same type of thing. And I was trying to get it on my iPad here, but I know you could probably just look up the journeys, the quality of life scale, and that will come up. And that's a really good thing to just sit down, because it gives you a number. You can actually apply a number to each thing. And when you start getting to that point where those numbers are dropping, it's time to say, you know, I'm doing this for me and not for my dog. So, But it sounds like right now, you know, yeah, he's blind and has some orthopedic problems, but you're able to meet all his needs. And I hope you can have him for a lot longer. But I think you're wise to be having these thoughts right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had setters, and I haven't had them go over 12 years, and I'm just like, this is crazy. But I live out in the country, and I have to keep him chained up, because if I let him off the chain, he starts hunting, and he won't come back for a whole day.
And with his vision impaired, that could be a real challenge, yeah.
Right.
My goodness. Sounds like a wonderful... Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Myra. Sounds like a wonderful, wonderful dog. Well, we have lots of callers. We have Georgia emailed and said her family's moving to Europe for a year without their two cats, wondering if there are long-term cat sitters out there, and what are your recommendations for making the transition from one house to another easier for the cats?
I don't know of any long-term pet sitters, but I would probably first start with family members and friends that may be in the area, preferably ones that maybe don't have a cat, so you don't have to go through that social introduction of bringing your cats in. But most cats would tolerate going to a new home very well. I know. And they just, you know, if you bring things like a blanket that they've laid on that smells like them, let them get used to one room in the home first and then gradually let them get to, you know, expand their territory a little bit. They adapt really, really well. And, you know, I know people that do take their pets with them when they travel. It depending on the country you're going to, there could be a lot of hoops to jump through to be able to get them over there, especially the rabies-free countries where you have to have rabies titers done, and it can take several months to get all the paperwork and everything prepared. So, but, you know, I think if you're going to be moving around while you're in Europe, the best places for your cat, best place would be a single home for the next year. But, yeah, again, trying to find one. Just put out all your feelers. Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be an issue. Now, along those lines, we have an issue. A friend has an issue with neighbors who have moved in with a dog, and the dog, when they leave, the dog whines and barks the entire time.
Oh my goodness! Yeah,
literally.
Yeah, I would really be worried that dog has a behavior problem of having separation anxiety, being afraid of being left alone in the house, especially if it's continuing all day long. And it would be something that if the owners don't know that that's happening, the neighbors should probably go over and just say, you know, your dog sounds like it's really in distress. And there are things that can be done to help these dogs. Medical management, behavior modification. I mean, we do see dogs barking and howling for other reasons, like alarm barking. They sit at the window and bark at everything that goes by, but usually that's going to be hit or miss. It's not going to be all day. So I really think this dog is probably anxious.
And probably needs some training and probably some help.
Yeah, probably medical. Some anti-anxiety medication and working with someone that can talk about how to go through a desensitization program to departure cues and so on.
Brad in Milwaukee, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, how you doing? I got a question about electric fences.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I own 5 acres of land, and we have a busy road in front of us. And I was wondering if the electric fence is actually going to keep them out of the road, because she likes to chase squirrels and rabbits.
Mm-hmm. It really depends on what you're talking about, kind of electric fence you're talking about. If you're talking about the collar. Okay. Yeah. What that is the wire is buried in the ground, and it emits a radio signal that triggers the collar to emit initially a tone as the dog approaches, and then a shock. And it kind of depends on the dog. The majority of dogs, you go through a training program where you have visual flags put in where the wire is buried. So the dog gets that visual cue, it gets the auditory cue of the sound, and it gets then the discomfort if they approach, and they learn to, okay, stay 4 feet away from that area. Eventually the flags disappear, and the majority of dogs do really well. Although I did have a family in a couple of weeks ago that have 4 dogs. One of them is a bloodhound, and she routinely, if she's motivated enough to go after wildlife, will just
grit her teeth and
go through it, because it's worth it to chase. And then she doesn't want to come home because she's not as motivated.
She can't get back in.
She's going to get shocked to get back in. So it depends on the dog. Probably the worst are some of the really like prey drive hunting dog dogs, will like beagles and so on, just disregard the collar and head off. And that's where you'd be better off.
Well, she's a Ridgeback, so.
Okay.
I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. So you probably, you know, it really depends on the dog. If you work with a company that is like one of the national based companies, they do have a money back guarantee. I don't know if I can be naming names here, but yeah. Invisible Fence, okay, mm-hmm. is one that I have had a lot of work with. And if it doesn't work out for whatever reason, they are very willing to help you with either further training, because they have people there that are, you know, well versed in how to train your dog, and they'll come out as often as you need to get your dog trained. But then if there are issues, they'll either fix it or give your money back and take everything back. So
my favorite story involving a fence like that is the people who had a dog who they put the collar on and did the training and all that. The dog got shocked a couple of times, you know, where you hear the tone. And finally it walked up, and the owner was watching it. It walked up, and the tone started, and the dog sat down. And the dog sat there, and sat there and sat there until the battery died and the tone went off, and then it ran across.
Oh, my goodness. Oh. You know, I had a dog, an owner that had a dog that went out, got shocked once, and learned that grass is evil. And the only way they could get the dog to leave their property was to go through the garage, put the dog in the car, back the car out of the driveway, get the dog out of the car in the street, and walk him. He would not go out, and he was terrified. It took, we had to desensitize him to just going in their yard after a single shock. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
all right, thank you, guys.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. The other favorite story involving one of those collars is the neighbors. The one couple had the dog with an electric fence, and they were at the neighbor's. And next door, having a grill outside, and the dog was whining and looking over, and the wife said to the husband, go over and get the dog. And so he walks over, he takes the collar off the dog, he sticks it in his pocket, and then starts to carry.
Oh, my goodness.
Got himself a little surprise there.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, there's all kinds of great stories out there. We have callers online. And we've got callers on Facebook. We had Abby. We have Abby. We'll go on Facebook and take a look at that, because there's a post on Facebook. We might have a picture of Abby. We'll get to that. And, of course, we'll take your questions and comments as well as we move along here today. And we've got about 30 seconds before we need to break for a look at the news, but often you advise about the number of litter boxes for cats, and that came up, and I thought, well, here's one we can handle pretty quickly.
A litter box for every cat plus one. So if you have one cat, two litter boxes, two cats, three litter boxes. So plan accordingly and have them in separate locations in your home. You don't want to group them all together, because that defeats the purpose of having multiple litter boxes.
And good size.
Good size, yeah. And think out of the box, using plastic storage bins and so on. The standard litter boxes that are available typically are too small for a cat.
And with that, we're going to take a quick look at the news, whether we'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net. And then we will be back with our guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. You stay with us. It's great to have happy, healthy pets to keep you company. So when you're under the weather, you want to get them the same quality care, or when they are, that you yourself would want. Certainly, that's the case for Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. She has some great advice about your pet's health. If your cat or your dog is ill, or maybe they've been involved in sort of a dog bite incident, we've been talking about that as well. She's here to offer her advice. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. And lots of callers online, and Claire and Baraboo's been waiting a while, so let's go to Claire. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. Thank you very much. And Sandy Sawchuk, you are a hero. I'm really a fan.
Thank you.
Since I live in Baraboo, I have two little adult dogs, age 8 and 9. We practically live at Devil's Lake in the summer, and, of course, there's a specific doggy area at Devil's Lake near the water. And I'm concerned, or I guess I wonder, what precautions should I be taking? They like to go, the first thing that they like to do is go down to the edge of the lake and drink some water, for example. I'm worried about that dog flu. There's a lot of people from Illinois that come up with their dogs. What special precautions, if any, should I be taking with them?
Well, I wouldn't worry too much about canine influenza from water consumption, although the canine influenza virus can survive for 12 to 24 to maybe even 48 hours on different objects. So like if they were sharing a water bowl or maybe a toy on the beach, there, that's a different story. But it's primarily spread through aerosols, where another dog coughs and the dog breathes in the bugs from exposure like that. But the things that I would be concerned about there's probably three things that come to mind. Number one is the bacterial infection called leptospirosis. It's a bacteria that loves to live in water and damp areas. And so making sure that your dogs are vaccinated for leptospirosis, they should be getting, there is a four-way vaccine out now. Lepto is one of those bugs that there's no cross protection between the different species. And over the years, we've seen a little bit of a shift as to which of the lepto organisms were commonly infected dogs to a couple of other ones. And so the vaccine in the last few years has been changed to a four-way vaccine. That is a vaccine that has to be given annually. Usually it requires two doses to start with. So talk to your veterinarian if you've not had your dog vaccinated for that. The other thing is a parasite that we don't have a vaccine for that is called Giardia. It's a parasite that can cause diarrhea, cramping, gas, and so on, vomiting. People can get it. Dogs can get it. The difference, though, is that even though we both get Giardia, they are different types of Giardia organisms. They get all read out the same, but it's very difficult for a human to infect a dog or a dog to infect a human. But in a dog, you know, area like that, if you've got another dog that's defecating, it's running into the lake, the perfect environment for Giardia to live. And so it just means that you need to be really watchful after your dog has been to an area like that. If they do break with any gastrointestinal signs, bring this up with your veterinarian that they have been drinking water out of a lake, and, you know, can you check for Giardia? And there's some specific testing that we do to be able to get an answer for that. Lastly, I always worry, especially in the summer, about blue-green algae, and they, you know, be watchful. If the lake looks like it's got algae, avoid having them drink out of it. I wouldn't even let them swim in it. Typically, most public areas like that will put signs up saying, you know, don't swim in this because of the algae blooms, but not always. So, you know, use your nose, use your eyes, and say, you know, if there's algae present, I'm not going to let you swim or drink out of there.
There you go. Okay. Thanks a lot, Claire, for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, Sandy, if I would urge everyone to go to our Facebook page today, to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and take a look at a photo that Daniel sent us of a dog, not his own dog,
but covered with porcupine quills. And his little statement above it is that a $10 leash could have saved you a lot of money and your dog a lot of pain. I totally agree. I mean,
I have never seen anything.
Not that,
that
we have
bad.
Porcupines down here, but people travel, and you know, you think it might be fun to just let your dog run through the woods. Well, that could happen.
Yeah, it is. It's really worth looking at that photo, because mm-hmm. you'll remember that every.
You'll have nightmares.
I'm pretty sure of that. Sue in Pulaski, it's your turn. Hi, Sue. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you. Doctor, we have an introduction problem. We've taken in a little 10-week-old boxer,
mm-hmm.
and I have a 3-year-old mixed breed. She's little. Right now she's smaller than the boxer pup.
Uh-huh.
And she's growling at him. She just doesn't want him.
No.
What's the best way to introduce them? I took her with when we got the puppy, and so she was introduced that way, brought him into the house. And do I just let Zoe go ahead and growl at him, and maybe is she talking to him? What's the best way to handle this?
Well, I'm going to back up a little bit. Did Zoe get along with other dogs prior to you adopting? Yes. Did she have playmates and so on?
No, and before I got her, another woman had her. I've had her 2 years. She's 3, and I have a feeling she was going to be used for breeding. She was not. She doesn't even play
okay.
with toys. Well, but I can take her to my daughter's house. There's a dog there. I can take her to my son's. There's two dogs, and there's no problem.
Yeah, and so she. It sounds like she's got a fairly good history of, you know, getting along with other dogs when it's not on her turf. And so I think that's always the best way of introducing dogs, is to do it in a neutral environment where there's not going to be anything like, this is my bed and I'm laying here and I don't want that puppy to come over and bug me while I'm in it. So they get used to each other in an environment similar to like what you taking her to your son or daughter's house. That's not her home. So that may be why she gets along better with those dogs. But puppies can be overly exuberant. They may not know how to read dogs' body signals and sounds that they're producing. So you need to be there to be able to redirect the puppy to be playing in a more appropriate way with your dog, because it sounds like she just doesn't know how to play. She doesn't know what toys are. It's going to be a while, but I'd be living in a house divided right now, and
okay,
I would.
That's what we are.
Yeah, I would not be reprimanding.
But not totally.
Yeah, I would not be reprimanding her for growling. I would just, you know, say if that happens, back up a little bit and say, okay, we've got the puppy came too close in a situation where you're feeling threatened. So let her get used to him, and maybe they can have, you know, time together. Out for walks together, or you know, in maybe a neighbor's yard, or even your own backyard. But in the house where there may be a lot of triggers, that's the time to really make sure that they're kept separate, and that your dog, your puppy, has an outlet for its energy other than taking after your 3-year-old dog.
Yeah, and he's a good pup. He's very laid back. He's sleeping a lot, and so he's just kind of being an old grump.
Yeah, but you know, just wait till that boxer gets bigger and becomes one of those, you know, terrible teens. You're going to and actually see how active these dogs can be. So don't assume that it's always going to be peaceful like that with your puppy.
There you go, Sue. Thank you for calling. Jim in Colfax up next. Jim, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks, Sandy and Larry. Start off with, once again, that Bayer collar is just the best thing in the whole world for my dog.
Okay, that's it. It's called the Seresto collar. Sure. Yeah, and for dogs and cats. Yeah.
Okay, so I got kind of two questions. One is, last night, I'll ask them, then you can just answer them because there won't be any more to it. But last night on the news, I seen they had something about, because ticks are up this year, and they said cats can't get Lyme's disease. So that's the first question.
Mm-hmm.
And the second one is, I was so to speak, a bad parent, and I didn't get the cat spayed in time. The cat became pregnant because it's an inside-outside cat, and rather than abort the kittens, even though they could have the first month or so, we just went ahead and said we'll have a litter of kitties, and we have a 3.5-year-old that would love to see the little kittens, which she does. I want to know how long before or after now, she just had them on May 5th, how long before I can actually take her in and have her spayed.
Okay.
And if it's feasible to do it, if it wasn't something that, you know, I've been told different through the years, I was, you know, cats all my life, but this is one that we definitely would like to have spayed. Now.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, good questions. First of all, cats tend to be, when it comes to some of the tick-borne diseases, quite resistant to Lyme. Does it mean that they won't get it? No, but they seem to be more resistant than other species like humans and dogs. But there are other tick-borne parasites or tick-borne diseases that cats can get. There's one that's actually spread by the Lone Star tick, which we're starting to see in the state now, that's called cytokinesis and can be fatal for cats. And so if you have an indoor-outdoor cat, in the past we were like, yeah, ticks are kind of a nuisance for them. Most cats are able to groom them off if it's in a spot that they can get to. If you may see them around the head and so on, but usually it's not a huge deal for them. But now it's become a huge deal. So even indoor-outdoor cats should have some type of flea and tick prevention on them, and the Seresto collar would be perfect for your cat. I don't know if I'd have to do my homework to see if you can use it safely with nursing kittens around. I don't know. I really don't know. I'd have to look at the packaging for that as to whether it would be safe. I would assume it would be, but it would be something I'd have to look into. As to how long to wait to spay her, This is a dilemma. She's got, you know, she's nursing her kittens right now. She's going to have large mammary glands, and that can make a big furrow where the incision would go. Usually we would recommend waiting until the kittens are 6 to 8 weeks of age and then get her spayed, but she can come into heat while she's still nursing her kittens and get pregnant again. So make sure that she is kept indoors. Don't let her outside while you've got those kittens, because you don't want to be put in that situation again. And that's why birth control for cats is such a problem, because they'll just keep having litters even while they're nursing. They'll get pregnant. So, yeah.
Inside is good anyway.
It is. It's the safest place for them. And then you don't have to worry about putting a tick collar on them. Yeah.
And they tend to live longer.
They do. Yes, they do live longer.
Thanks, Jim, for calling. Appreciate it. Kay in Wisconsin Dells, your turn. Hi, Kay.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a dog. I'd like to do some traveling with him, but he gets car sick. He doesn't mind getting in the truck at all with me. And if we just go up to a couple miles and come home, go to the dump on Saturdays, he's fine. But if I go further than that, and if I stop at a store and get out when I come back, it's probably that he's thrown up in the car, or some days he'll even throw up as we're driving in the driveway.
Okay. Well, a couple of things. If you can plan ahead, you know, obviously no ammo in the tummy, so have them held off food in the morning. If it's going to be a short trip, that's very helpful, and then feed them when you get to your destination. Some dogs do better when they're in a crate in the car that is facing forward, in the back seat, and, you know, maybe put a blanket over it so they can't see the world whizzing by on the outside, and that may be helpful as well, rather than having them loose in the vehicle. But there are safe medications that you can use, and one that we use quite commonly for travel sickness is one called Serenia, and it's a once every 24-hour tablet. So if you're going on longer trips and you can anticipate we're going to be in the car for a while, it's not sedating. It's very, very helpful for stopping some of this nausea. And, you know, in the past, we were forced to use things like human Dramamine, which is an antihistamine that can make them really groggy, or Acepromazine, which would be a sedation drug that also has some antiemetic effects, and they'd be wiped for 12 to 24 hours on that as well. So don't discount using medication. This would be a prescription you'd have to get through your veterinarian, though.
Okay.
And that's Serenia?
Serenia, yep.
Okay.
Okay. I have already the Acepromazine.
Acepromazine, yeah.
And that works, but he is wiped out the rest.
Oh yeah,
of the
their third eyelids are up. They're you know, really sedated, and you have to plan ahead if it's going to be a long trip. You know, using the Serenia, they'll be able to get out of the car and be their old normal self again. And it's spelled Serenia.
Serenia.
Mm-hmm.
There you go, Kay. Thank you so much. Appreciate the call, Kelly in Greenville. Thank you for calling. Let's see if I can get you on. Hi, Kel.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. So about 2 months ago, my girlfriend and I adopted a pointer pit bull mix, and he's about 3 years old. We haven't had any problems with him behaviorally. You know, he picked up potty training really well. He's fitting into the family with our other dog really well. The only thing we're seeing that kind of has us stumped is when he sees me and the girlfriend hug or my parents hug, you know, that display of affection, he'll start jumping up on us to try and get us to stop. And we're just wondering where that behavior might have come from. You know, he's got 3 years of time where he was down in Georgia that we just don't know about. So we're wondering what kind of would be the basis for that so we could start working with him on it.
Yeah, I mean, we see this a lot. I used to have a dog that whenever I would start, like, dancing to the music, like, music's playing, I'm in the kitchen, she would come running in and start barking and jumping on me, you know? And it was like, well, you know, all I'm doing is, you know, wiggling my hips a little bit and dancing while I'm stirring the soup. But, you know, that she would do that. So it may just be that, you know, it just is one of those things that gets him kind of overly excited. Have you taught him how to do just a good sit-stay? That would be your best thing that you could do, is that he will learn, okay, sit, stay, and then you gradually, you know, introduce another person, and you get closer and closer until you're hugging, and he stays on a sit stay, and while you're hugging, you toss bits of food to him, so he learns this is wonderful. When people are in close contact, I keep my fanny on the ground, and wonderful things happen. But, you know, if he's not being aggressive, if he's just, you know, jumping at you, I would guess that it's probably more just he's just excited. And why that triggers it, I don't know. But, you know, dancing at my house, hugging at yours. So
there you go. Thanks, Kelly, for calling. Appreciate it. Bob in Wauwatosa, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. We're looking at getting a 3-year-old English Cocker Spaniel from a woman who raises and shows these dogs. She's very experienced, lives for her dogs, a wonderful person, but I just don't know what questions we ought to be asking her.
Well, I mean, this is a good for you for looking into this, because adopting an adult dog, it's going to come with a lot of baggage, as you've heard from some of the other callers earlier. One thing that you're dealing with someone who's a breeder and you're adopting a dog is asking them what kind of their guarantee is. And I have a very simple guarantee that I like to hear from breeders, and it may sound extreme, but I like to have them say it's lifetime. What I mean by that is that you have a breeder then that is going to make sure that whatever dogs they are producing and selling or placing are the healthiest they can be. They've checked them for genetic defects. They make sure that they do appropriate breeding to alleviate some of these problems that we may see that could be detrimental to the dog later in life. That you've got a good family tree of you know, what illnesses dogs have had. And so depending on the breed that you're getting, you want to know, you know, hey, you know, did this dog have epilepsy, or, you know, have you ever had that in your line? So do your homework and just see, you know, is the breeder breeding for the best dogs they possibly can? And the other end of it is they want to make sure that that dog is being placed in a home that is going to be the best for the dog. So don't be surprised if you are grilled as well regarding how you're going to care for the dog, because they don't want to see that dog ruined and then, you know, because it's a lifetime guarantee, going to come back to them. A good breeder would take, if for some reason you can't keep the dog, they would take the dog back and make sure
even
10 years later, and make sure it's placed in another home that would be appropriate for that particular dog, or keep it. They made it. And so that's what I would like to see. If they, you know, just because money is exchanged hands, it doesn't mean that they can wash their hands of you and the dog. And I think that is what that would be, in my mind, a really good breeder association.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. So it's very simple, but that's what I'd be looking into. And you do your homework regarding, you know, genetic defects and health problems of the breed, and ask pointed questions about what they're, you know, what they've done to try to prevent them, what testing they do. You'd be surprised at how many people come in with a new dog, like a German Shepherd, and I'll say, did the parents get tested for hip dysplasia? Oh no, they just told me that they've never seen it in the line. No, that would be a breeder that I would just walk away from. Oh. So, yeah.
Good, very good. And Dr. Okay. Patricia McConnell says, the same exact
okay.
same thing.
Okay, good. I'm reading a new book right now that is called, I don't know if it's new, but it's called Pukka's Promise, P-U-K-K-A, _S, Search for the Long-Lived Dog. And phenomenal book about how to go about looking for a dog. Obviously, this guy took it to the extreme, but wonderful book. So recommend it to anybody that wants to, you know, see the mistakes they've made, maybe like I have when I've adopted dogs.
What was that title again?
Pukka's, P-U-K-K-S, Promise. And it's by Ted Karasot, I believe is the author's name, with a K.
Karasov.
Karasov, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I guess a good writer.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And here we are, pretty much out of time. Man, oh yeah. man.
One thing I just wanted to bring up is keep those laundry pods away from your dogs. You know, those little detergent things? They've been getting more and more calls to the Poison Control Center. You know, dogs can lick detergent and it's irritating to the mouth and so on, but if they lick it off the floor, they may get sick and so on, but it's not a big deal. But what they're seeing is these things are under so much pressure, the dog bites into them and they inhale it and swallow it and it burns their lungs. It's very caustic. So keep them out of reach, not only of for dogs, but children as well.
And on that note, we can... Sandy, thank you so much.
Hey, you're welcome.
You're back the second, June 9th.
There we go. Yep.
She will be back on June 9th. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Always great to have her along and look forward to her next visit. And looking ahead to tomorrow, we'll talk about the importance of pollinators and how we can support them. And then the Wetlands Association joins us as well, the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.